Well, we're going to have fun tonight. First, I have to give you this little commercial, I think, so we'll get this out of the way. Pain is inevitable, but misery is optional, so stick a geranium in your hat and be happy. Now, when I wanted that title, the publisher said, oh, you know, that'll never sell. I mean, who's going to buy a book about a geranium? And so I had a real struggle with them to get the title I wanted, and now it's sold a million copies, so they think I know a little bit about titles anyway. And so this is based on Job 8:21. He will fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouts of joy. And then I like this book, Splashes of Joy in the Cesspools of Life. Now, I did a program with Dr. Dobson one day. It was right after he finished that pornographic thing, and he wasn't too happy. He was depressed is what he was. And so I said, let me come back another day, and we'll tape it when you feel better. And he said, no, if there's anything I need today, it's a splash of your joy. I thought, oh, that'd be a good title for a book, Splashes of Joy. And then I wanted to have In the Cesspools of Life. But the publisher said, oh, no, the Christian world is not ready for a word like cesspools. You should say in the potholes of life or in the mud holes of life. And I said, life is not a mud hole. It is a cesspool. I'm out there working. I know what to. So finally they said, well, you know, let her have her way. So now this book sold like 300,000, doing really good. But one of the back page of the book says something that I think is so great. And I photocopied it, and I got it in my car, the bathroom, and the kitchen, and all over. It says, memo, gone to father's house to prepare your place. We'll be back soon to pick you up. And it's signed, Jesus. That's worth the whole price of the book. Okay. Now this book, Pack Up Your Gloomies. You don't give me any trouble about names now, so this is okay. Pack up your gloomies in a great big box, sit on the lid and laugh. This is so new that I had the same dress on that I had on for that picture. So either it tells you that I don't have many clothes. But anyway, we think this book is going to be helpful. And then I have a fabulous book here. I didn't write it, so I can tell you how wonderful it is. But it is just fabulous. It says, What Men Understand About Women, A Radical Peek Inside the Minds of Men. And then inside, it's absolutely blank. Could sell a million of those books. Well, I'm going to take you tonight to tell you my story. Now, you can laugh anywhere you want to. It's not a real happy story, but that's okay. You can laugh anywhere you want to because God has filled me with so much joy and energy. And sometimes when I tell my whole story, people will come up and say, wow, after I heard your story, I don't have any problems at all. And I think, isn't it good that God has taken all the brokenness and all the barriers of pain in my life, and he's healed those fractures, and he's filled me with such an abundance of joy that I can share that with you. Now, I see some of you women fanning yourselves. I'm not the only one between estrogen and death. Or between the Blue Lagoon and Golden Pond, whatever it is. So you just be comfortable. You undo anything that doesn't feel good. Take off your shoes. And we're going to have a good time for the next, however it takes me to get through this. And I want you to laugh a lot. Even if it extends the message, that's okay. I want you to laugh so that when you go out of here, you will have laughed and maybe cried a little bit. And you will feel so relieved because laughter and tears sort of go together. I'm taking you back to 1966. My husband and I had four children, two teenagers and two were under 12. And he was an engineer, and we had a nice, active in our Baptist church, and we had a nice home and a swimming pool in California, and no problems. But then within a period of 9 years, we had four tragedies happen to us, any one of which would sink Molly Brown. But we were going to go be counselors with our young people's group from our church up to in the mountains near us to a retreat for Easter weekend. And so he went on ahead of me that night, and he took things like the popcorn and the caramel corn and the pop and the popsicle, you know, all the fun things. He went ahead, and I came behind him about a half an hour with the kids. That's how it works, girls. And it was a dark night, and this mountain road that he had to go up there had been doing some construction work in the on the way up to this retreat we were going. And I came behind him about a half an hour, and as I got to within 10 miles of the retreat center where we were going to be counseling, I found this heap of a man lying in the middle of the road, all covered with blood and glass. There was no way to recognize it was my husband except by his clothes. Evidently, he'd hit some debris in the road that caused the accident. I got out of the car, and I wasn't even sure he was alive. I had to leave one of the children with him while I went up 10 miles to get to a telephone to call the ambulance to take him back down the mountain because I was the first in a caravan of cars, and I knew the other cars would run over him. So I left him there and left one of the boys with him, and I drove up to the telephone. to take him back. I won't go into all the details because it is in the books, and please buy the books. It's in the books. And so it was 2 days later that a neurosurgeon and an ophthalmologist came out to talk to me and said that he was blind. He was having, every few minutes, he was having seizures that were uncontrollable. And they said he's completely unrehabilitatable. There's no way that he can live more than 5 years because he has many blood clots in his brain. And they gave me the medical terminology for all the things that he had wrong with him. And they said there's no way he can ever fit into a family because he will never know anybody, and then being blind, and he will never have any remembrance. And they said the best thing you can do is to arrange to have him put in Sawtelle Veterans Hospital to live the rest of his life. He'd been a lieutenant commander in the Navy, so he could qualify for veterans care. Here we were 2 days before, nice, happy family, active in our church, all Christians, and he was an engineer. We had no financial problems, and all of a sudden, I'm supposed to see about getting him put in a veterans hospital to live the rest of his life. And the doctors had said, well, he can't live more than 5 years anyway, but 5 years is a long time, and you have to live in a veterans hospital. So while he was still in the hospital, intensive care, I went out to get on some programs. I got my white cane. I knew how to do that. And then I went to get on Social Security, a veterans pension, aid of the blind, all these things that we had to get on. And the insurance paid me $20,000, $10,000 for each eye because he was blind. I had that. I spent that quickly. And then I got the Veterans Administration paid off the loan on our house because he was ruled completely unrehabilitatable. So here I had all this money coming in, Social Security, aid of the blind, veterans pension, food stamp, everything you could get, I had it. And just as I had gotten on all those programs, the Lord healed him. He's still a little bit strange, but he's an only child, and they're all a little bit strange. And so I thought, what am I going to do about it? I spent the $20,000. I don't even have that. And the insurance said, no, we never had a case like this before. I mean, he was blind when he gave you the money, and that's right. He did qualify, and now that he's not blind, I mean, we know what to do. And I said, well, I don't have the money anyway, so that takes care of that. And then the Veterans Administration, can you imagine the veterans paying off a loan and trying to get them to reverse it? I mean, they couldn't figure out how to do that either. And so they said, well, let that go. So we went through here. Our house is paid off. We had the $20,000, which I spent, and I had my husband, which I think he's around here somewhere. Bill, if you want to come up and say hello, wherever you are, please. It's a little difficult. I thought you'd come the other way, but never.
That last step gets you. It's sure a real joy to be able to come along with Barb and be here tonight with her. And since I've retired, I really enjoy being able to go along and see how the Lord has operated in her life and been able to give her lots of little things like using the gifts that she has of being able to speak and to write and to counsel. And that's one of the things that I've learned to enjoy because I've found out that I've been able to love and appreciate her a lot more now than I used to be able to. Now,
are they taping this? Go ahead.
Oh, you want a commitment, huh? But a while back we were out on a tour about similar to this, but they had a conference afterwards and they had exhibits and so forth. And I have a pin on tonight that they took a picture of two of us while we were walking around, and they put it inside of a frame and it says best friends. And when they did that, it brought home something to me that you go along for years about thinking about it, and you start out when you're younger and having best friends and so forth, but it really brought home to me one of the most important things in almost any relationship, I think, is to be best friends to start with, and this is what we try to be. And I think you're all going to have a real rewarding weekend this week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So he was going back to work as an engineer, but the DMV takes a very dim view of giving you a driver's license when they see that you've been blind and had seizures. I mean, nobody wanted to give him a road test. That was obvious. So I had to drive him back and forth to work. He was back as an engineer, but we had a little problem with the DMV to get that straightened out. And then 2 years later, he still wasn't driving. I was taking him back and forth, and we had a beautiful son. His name was Stephen. He was going to be 18 years old, and that was when we thought the Vietnam conflict was dying down. It was dying down, decelerating. He wanted to go in the Marines. Well, he hadn't had his 18th birthday yet, and you know, I knew he'd be grousing around the house for a few months, so I went down and signed the paper that he could go in, because all of his friends had gone in, and we thought that everything was slowed down. And as soon as he got in, he had his 18th birthday, then he didn't want to be in, but you know, once you have the 18th birthday, there's no way out. And so, he was in. And as soon as he finished his training, everything just escalated over in Vietnam. Everything just went up, and he was sent immediately over to Vietnam after he finished at Camp Pendleton. From the letters he wrote home, we knew that God had especially drawn him close to him. Of course, he was seeing boys all around him being killed, and a lot of his friends. And the training he got at home didn't show up when he was at home. But when he got over there in the crisis, his letters reflected a lot of growth and a lot of depth that we hadn't seen when he was at home. That happens sometimes. On the 28th of July, a Marine car drove up in front of our house and said that Stephen and all of his buddies had been wiped out in a big push that they had in Da Nang. 10 days later, I got a call from a mortician employee near us, and he said, Mrs. Johnson, the law says that the next of kin has to come and identify the body of someone shipped in from a foreign country, and you'll have to come up here and identify Stephen's body. Well, Bill wasn't even driving the car yet, but I went by myself this hot day on the 8th of August, 1968, and I went up there, and I remember thinking, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Only once in a lifetime will I be coming up here to look at a boy in a box. And when I went in there, I stood at a little podium, a little man stood here, and in this hermetically sealed box, they only show you the top half, so you don't even know if there's anything below the waist. But in this box was this brown, swollen, bloated-faced boy, and I said, well, no way, that can't be. I mean, he doesn't even look like a white boy. I mean, how could he look like that? And the man read from a little paper, and he said he laid face down in a rice paddy for 3 days before they found him. And that accounted for the discoloration and the bloating and the swelling. And so I signed the paper, and when I went out that day, I remember thinking, now, we've had the cup of suffering. Bill's had his accident, and he's getting back to where he was. And we had this beautiful deposit in heaven. Stephen was a Christian boy. He knew the Lord. He was our deposit in heaven. We had a beautiful memorial service for him. We called it Safe in the Arms of Jesus, because that was the song that we had sung at our church the day he left to go in service. And we had a little brochure printed up with his picture on the front, and inside was the last letter he'd written home, and 4 spiritual laws on the back. And that was the beginning of our working with parents who had lost children in the Vietnam conflict. Now I'm taking you ahead to 1973. And this is our older son. His name was Tim. He was 23 years old. 1973. The poor choir doesn't get to see much, do they? But the back of me, not too good. And so he was going to take a trip up to Alaska. He'd finished 2 years of college and was going to go up there and come back and finish the rest of college. Now, he looks like a happy boy, but he was boring is what he was. He was dull because he worked at Rose Hills Mortuary, and his real epitome was fun is when they had extra bows at the mortuary. He would bring home these bows and put them on the dog and cat. And if I came home and the dog had a big bow that said, may he rest in peace, or God bless Grandpa Hiram. I mean, that was his idea of fun. He was not fun. I was telling this recently up in Seattle, and a little old lady came up. She said, oh, Mrs. Johnson, I feel so bad to think that your son brought home the bones from the mortuary. I said, honey, it was the bows. I don't want to get sued by Rose Hills Mortuary. But anyway, he went to things like Campus Crusade, and he went to our Baptist church camp, and they had to pay him to go. I bought him a set of tires to get him to go to camp 1 year. But I mean, he never came home excited. He never talked about it. He was dull. That's the only word. He was dull. So he went up to Alaska, and while he was up there, he wrote us that he was baptized. Well, this really hurt my feelings, because we had good water at our church. Why would he get baptized up in Anchorage? But anyway, he wrote us some letters, and I knew that something had happened when he'd been up there at this church called Abbot Loop Chapel in Anchorage. This is in the mid-70s when the Holy Spirit was really doing a work with a lot of young people up there. And so he called me on the 1st of August. Now, see, I like a new month. I celebrate. I take a bath and wash my hair and change the sheets and other times, too. But I think the first of the month is fabulous, and I like to pull off that calendar, and I've got a whole new month. I haven't even messed it up or done anything wrong or anything. I have a whole new month, and I just love that. And so I brought up my kids, and on the first of the month is my holiday. I pamper myself. I don't do any work. I don't cook. I don't do anything I don't want to do. I have a day. That way I have a lot more holidays than the rest of the world. I used to take my kids to Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm or go have a picnic and have fun, but then the teachers got wise to that and I had to quit that. But anyway, he knows that the first of the month was very meaningful to me. So I got a collect call from him on the 1st of August, and he said, always collect, you know. And he said, what are you doing to celebrate the first of the month? And I said, well, I'm just waiting for a collect call from you. And he said, well, Ron and I are on our way home, and we'll be home in 5 days, and I can't wait to tell you what the Lord's done in my life. Well, what? I mean, you're a Christian boy. You go up there. Whatever happened? And he said, well, I'll be home in 5 days to tell you about it. And he said, I've got a sparkle in my eye and a spring in my step. Wow, this didn't sound like Tim at all. And he said, I'll be home in 5 days. I can't wait to get home and tell you what the Lord's done in my life. Well, I could hardly wait either. So I hung up the phone and I called my sister in Minneapolis because he spent one summer there and she knew he was dull too. And I said, I got a call from Tim, collect call. He's up in the Yukon. He's on his way home. And he says he'll be home in 5 days. And he says he's got a sparkle in his eye and a spring in his step. Oh, she said, boy, it doesn't sound like Tim. I said, I know, something's happened to that kid. And so I sat down for dinner with my two younger boys and my husband. And I was telling him about this phone call, how excited he was. And we were just marveling because we never heard him get excited except about the bows at the mortuary. And just then the phone rang, and it was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And they said that some drunk boys in a car, in a truck, hit Tim's little Volkswagen, and he and his friend were ushered immediately into the presence of God. And I said, this can't be. I mean, this can't be, because I just talked to him. I mean, his voice was still ringing in my ears. I just talked to him, and he's on his way home, and he's going to tell us what happened. And I was mad at God. I think that's not fair. I have one deposit in heaven. I don't need another deposit in heaven. And as I was going through the house screaming, I was mad at God to think this could happen to us. The phone rang again. It was the pastor of this church up in Anchorage, and he said, we're not going to let those two boys' story die up in the Yukon. We want to come down and tell you what God really did in their lives and bring you up on all this. Oh, well, it was wonderful, because how else was I going to know what all had happened? So I could see that there was something exciting was in the air. And then evidently, the day before Tim started home, he'd written letters to a lot of girls he used to go with, and he was not as dull as I thought he was. Because I had these darling girls coming over, a couple airline stewardesses, a couple college girls that he'd gone with. And in the letters, he was saying, please forgive me for being a creep. Every mother wonders what that was. And these beautiful girls come here wanting to know about the changes, about the letters he'd written. That just before the day before he started home, he'd written these wonderful letters. And so we could see they wanted to know. It was like plucking fruit off of a tree to lead them to the Lord. And the other boys' parents weren't Christians. They came to our house to get all the news because they had called us instead of them. And they accepted the Lord that very night. So you see, already we were seeing the warmth of the Holy Spirit working through lives, and they hadn't even gotten home to share. 10 days later, I got a call from this same mortician who had called me 5 years ago to the day. And he said, Mrs. Johnson, we never had to do this before, call the same family twice. But Tim was killed in a foreign country, the Yukon. I didn't know where the Yukon was, but I heard about Sergeant Preston and some sled dogs or something. But the Yukon is Canada, and he said, you'll have to come up here and identify Tim's body because he was killed in a foreign country. Well, I went by myself 5 years ago to the day. I didn't want to have anybody else go through that. So I went by myself driving up to the 8th of August again, 5 years from the day I was there with Stephen. And as I was driving up, I was thinking, this is the same car I had 5 years ago. We don't change cars very often. It's the same car I had 5 years ago, and I'm going up here to look at another boy in a box. I mean, this is so unreal. Unreal. I can't believe it's happening. But I went up to the place, and I went into this mortuary, and I'm standing at the same little table I stood at five, and here's this little same little man standing next to me. And I remember thinking, that's the same dumb carpeting they had 5 years ago. It's the same dumb wallpaper they had 5 years ago, and this same little man standing there. The only difference is I'm looking at another boy in a box. And when you've been in the front seat of a Volkswagen hit by a 3-ton truck, there's not a lot left to look at. But I looked at, first thing, they had him in a sort of the remains were in sort of a crate with wire around it. And I said, well, can't we put him in a casket, not in this? And they said, well, we have to identify him the way he came in the country before we can move anything. And so I looked at what they told me was my firstborn son. And I signed a paper that this boy belongs with this box. And when I went out that day, God did something so special for me. It never happened before or since, but I never needed it before or since. But I looked up, and you can always hear the crows in that place, and you can always smell the grass, because they're always cutting the grass. Did you know that? They're always cutting the grass. And I looked up, and I saw this boy's face, and all around it, he he was smiling, and there was gold, and it was just shining and bright. And I'm not from a persuasion where we have anything happen like this. But he was smiling, and he was saying, "Don't cry, Mom, because I'm not there. I'm rejoicing around the throne of God." It was just like God wrapped me in his comfort blanket to remind me that he hadn't forsaken me. He hadn't negated us. He still loved us. We needed that special touch. I needed that special touch to go ahead and have this memorial service we had. So many people turned out. Many young people came to know the Lord. The people from Alaska came down and shared. And it was just wonderful. And we could see, even though they hadn't gotten home, the message got down here. An article was written called "Their Death Was Only the Beginning," about these two boys who started home. They never did get home to share, but God in a real special way used their stories. And we had a beautiful memorial service. And from then on, it was just like really going as far as this, his story got spread around Alaska and so many other places. This happened in August. It was getting towards Christmas, and I was thinking, oh, Christmas is going to be the pitch, you know, with two empty chairs at the table. Stephen is gone. Tim is gone. It's going to be the pits. Christmas can be the pits when you've lost a loved one. It can even be the pits if you haven't lost a loved one. And I was dreading it. And just before Christmas, we had to go up to the Yukon to settle up some insurance claims and stuff. And we went on up to Anchorage to visit this church where the boys had spent the summer. And it's a big church, and people in Alaska, they don't have anything to do, so they just listen to tapes. And this church tapes everything. They're tapeworms up there. That's what they are. So they took us up to this church to see everything, and they were real delighted to have us come and visit. And they had a tape room that's about the size of your whole choir loft up here. They tape everything. They have services. There's nothing they don't tape up there. And people come from all over Alaska, and they get the tapes, or else they tape the message themselves. And then they spread these tapes. So Alaska is really a land of tapes. And so I asked what was the simple question. I'd like to have a tape the night my son was baptized and gave his testimony. And they said, "Oh, we're sorry, but it didn't get taped that night." Well, that's a pits. Why didn't it? Well, because the man who did the taping, he was baptized. I guess nobody else could push the button. I thought, well, that's so unfair. All I asked for is one tape. I mean, I only want one tape, and they got thousands of tapes. And the one night that my kid talked, they don't have it. It seems so unfair. I was so mad at God. But, you know, he never said, "Well, off to hell with you." He loved me anyway, but I thought it was really unfair. See, life is unfair, but God is fair. So I came home, and I just thought, you know, God really doesn't care about me, because that's all I wanted was one tape, and they didn't tape it that night. And then on December the 14th, my birthday, if you want to send a present, a card is all right. In the mail came a beat up, chipped up, emerald colored tape like it was used 1,000 times over from Kmart. I have no idea what it was because it didn't have any return address on it, and they hadn't taped it at the church. So I put it on my machine, and it started out clear as a bell. "Hi, I'm Tim Johnson. I'm from California. I want to tell you what the Lord did in my life." And then he went on and told about it. And at the end he said, "Wow, I don't know, I must have been like a sour lemon before." And I thought, boy, ain't that the truth. And then you heard the water splashing, 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 and heard him come up and say, "Praise the Lord." Now, this is the kid that didn't even want to go out for dinner with us if we were going to sing happy birthday, because he just got so embarrassed by his weird family. And here he's saying, "Praise the Lord." And then I turned the tape over, and on the other side was the other man. He said, "My name is Ron. I'm up here from California with Tim." And he said, "I'm excited to go home because my dad's an alcoholic and my mother's not a Christian, and I want to share Jesus with him." And see, subsequently, his parents had become Christians and were active in a good Bible-believing church. And so here I'm hearing my son's story, which was so clear, like as if he was standing 2 feet from me, and heard the water splashing just like I could feel that, and then hear the other boy. It was such a miracle that we got a tape. You see, how we got it was one of the bush pilots that flies around the bushes, I guess, or wherever they fly. I don't know where bush pilots fly, but he was up in Nome, Alaska, and he found a fisherman from Nome, Alaska, the end of the world, who had come to the church and taped it. And everybody up there heard about these two boys that were killed, and so he sent it directly to my house instead of sending it to the church. And then I got a letter from the church about a month later, said, "We finally located someone who has the tape." Well, see, if I had waited for the church, I wouldn't have got it till Groundhog Day. And as it was, I got that for Christmas. So you see how the Lord does care for these small things in our life. He does care. He does wrap us in his comfort blanket to remind us how much he loves us. So now we were working with parents who had lost children in death. We had Stephen was already deposited in heaven. Tim was already deposited in heaven. And I would go out when there was some kind of a bus tragedy or train accident or something, and pastors would have me come and speak about my two deposits in heaven and how important it is to train our children when they're young to know the Lord, because we think we're going to go first, but many times it's the other way around. I had two left. We started out with four. Two were deposits in heaven. One younger one, Barney, who's married now and got girls, is the exact, looks like this darling drummer up here. So if you want to know what Barney looks like, he looks like this darling drummer. I couldn't hardly keep my eyes off of him tonight. There's two, but it's the one on this side. Two drummers meet. Anyway, what's that one? Anyway, so I wanted you to know I have one nice, darling, all-purpose, wonderful boy that looks just like the drummer, and he's got two little girls. But I'm going to tell you about the third one. His name was Larry, and in 1975, he had just come back from a trip to Russia, and he traveled with a Christian singing group. He was president of the class, president of the choir, outstanding, darling, talented young man, and he was 19 years old, and he graduated on the 13th of June from a local two-year college, and Dr. Lloyd Ogilvy gave the address. He's the pastor of Hollywood Presbyterian Church, if some of you don't know who he is. And so that night, my son led the whole outdoor auditorium in the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and he had this beautiful gold and blue robe, and he won all these awards, scholarships to schools and all. So Dr. Ogilvy got up and said, "I'd like to meet this young man's parents, and I hope they have a car with a big trunk to carry home all his glory." So Bill and I went forward, very grateful to talk to him, and he said, "I've had a chance to talk to your son, and God's got his hand on his life. He's very talented and gifted, and I know God's going to use him in a special way." Wow, that's like God telling me that, you know? And then he said, "What kind of a car do you have?" And I said, "Well, we have a Chevy." And he said, "Oh, I'm glad you don't have a Volkswagen to carry home all of your son's trophies." And so we packed everything in the trunk of the car, the scholarship papers, the baton, the choir robe, the whole thing, put it in the trunk of the car. And as any proud mother, I went home and I put it up on the mantle, put all the scholarship papers, and I thought, now we lost Stephen and we lost him. But this kid embodies all the things that we wanted for our kids, the training he's had, the gifts God's given. This kid is really going to amount to something for the Lord. Now, the next day was June the 14th, 1975. It was the beginning of the bicentennial at Disneyland, and it was the beginning of the Electric Light Parade. And my sister, who lives in Minneapolis, she's married to a minister and worked for Billy Graham at the time. They were in Hawaii, but they were going to spend one 24-hour period with us. That's when you could buy those tickets and stay one day in L.A. and go on home. And so they were going to spend one day with us. This is the first time we'd seen them since Tim's memorial service. So it was going to be a wonderful family day, and we were going to Disneyland, stay all night at the Travelodge Motel, and see the Electric Light Parade and the Bicentennial. And then the next day was Father's Day, and we were going to have Father's Day dinner at Knott's Berry Farm after we went to church. And we were going to do all this. And we had 24 hours where we couldn't have anything go wrong because we didn't have much time. I went down to the hotel where we were going to stay at, and I short-sheeted the beds. And I put, you know, "Welcome to California" and the fruits and the nuts and all these things you do when you want to impress tourists and stuff. And so everything was great. I was going to leave and go to the airport to pick them up. My husband was at work. My son was rehearsing for his Christian singing group. And as I went out the door, someone called and wanted to borrow his basic youth book, which we all had because we all went to that. And probably you've got one shoved in a drawer somewhere. And I went into his room to lift up the basic youth book, and underneath it was a whole stack of homosexual magazines and pictures and literature and letters that he'd written to somebody and letters that came to him to a post office. It was a whole life under there. I thought, well, this can't be his. I mean, he just graduated last night. I mean, this can't be his. But the letters had his name on them, and it was his writing. I knew it was a whole life there. I've got to get to the airport. I just got to hold together till these people leave. They're not even there. I wish they could leave. And I said, this can't be his. How could this could happen to a Christian family? I mean, we're a Christian family. This doesn't happen to Christian people. And I realized, I can't leave this stuff in the house. Somebody might find it. So I grabbed two whole armloads of all this stuff, and I threw it in the trunk of my car. I didn't even cover it with anything. And then I thought, last night my car was full of glory, and now my trunk is full of garbage. I'd like to call Dr. V. Ogilvy and tell him, but I don't know his number. I haven't got time to call him, but I got to get to the airport. And then I thought, well, I've got to write him a note because all his stuff will be missing. He will wonder what happened to it. And so I wrote him a note, and I said, "Dear Larry, I found the stuff. I don't know what you call it, but I found the stuff. And I have it with me so he wouldn't go looking for it. And I said, please meet us at the flagpole at Disneyland, and we will just fix it tomorrow. We will fix it tomorrow. I mean, we'll just kill them, that's all. I will kill them. There's got to be a shot or a pill or a Band-Aid or injection or something, because we can't have this. And then I signed it. I said, God loves you. I'm not too sure about that, but I said that. And then I said, love, mother. Well, I got in the car with my trunk full of all these homosexual magazines, driving to the airport, and all of a sudden I felt like I had an elephant standing on my chest. I was gasping and choking. I was making sounds like a bull was goring. I'm like, oh, these awful sounds coming out of me. I never heard anybody like that. And I live an hour from the LA airport, and I sobbed and choked all the way, and my teeth were itching, and I had all these physical signs of panic. And I said, I picked up my husband half dead on the road, and I buried two sons, and I never had this. Just because my trunk is full of all these homosexual magazines, and I'm joking, I'm dying, I'm never going to get through the weekend. I finally got to the airport. I was late by this time, and I ran in there, and my sister said, oh, you look awful. That's a great greeting. And I said, it's just something I can't swallow. And then I remembered my trunk was full of this stuff, and I said, my trunk doesn't open. Now, who would go to the airport to pick up people with a trunk that doesn't open? But I thought, I can't open that trunk. I mean, it does see everything. They're only going to be here 24 hours. I can't. I got to keep the lid on this thing. And then we went to pick up her luggage, and she had two pieces of purple luggage. Now, I don't know much about homosexuality. I didn't know anything about homosexuality or lesbians. I didn't know about Rock Hudson. I didn't know about Dibarachi or anybody. And maybe you weren't too smart either. We used to sing that song, Don We Now Are Gay Apparel, you know. We don't sing that song a lot anymore, that verse. Anyway, and so here, we went to pick up her luggage, and she had two pieces of purple luggage. I don't know anything about it, but somewhere in my background, I thought that if you wear purple or you like purple, that you're a lesbian. But that's not true. Because purple is the color of royalty. It means you're a daughter of the king. But I didn't know that. I thought, my sister, who works for Billy Graham, and she's a lesbian. She's got purple luggage. And then my brother-in-law, who's a preacher, Baptist preacher, he said, we brought you a crate of pineapple from Hawaii. Crate of pineapple. I already said the door didn't open, trunk didn't open, and I got a crate of pineapple. I was just going crazy trying to get the pineapple in the car and get them in the car and get the purple luggage, and I was just, ugh. So I finally got them all in. And then as we're driving, I was driving from the LA airport to this hotel in Anaheim we're going to stay. We went by the great big A for the Angel Stadium. That's not even on the way, but we went by there somehow. That shows how I was driving. And my brother-in-law was pointing out the big A for the Angels, and I was thinking, oh, they're all homosexual there. They're all homosexual. It was just like the shade went up and the whole world was homosexual but me. And then we went by Schuler's Church, and they pointed that out. Oh, they're all homosexual there too, you know. So I was living in my little land, la-la land, you know. And somehow we got to the hotel, and they got out. They knew I was acting strange. I couldn't tell them why I was strange. And so they got out. They were going to change their clothes, and we're going to go across the street to Disneyland. Now, that night, because it was the bicentennial, and it was the beginning of the electric light thing, you had to get tickets way ahead. And we had bought tickets 6 months ahead to go to this wonderful thing. And as you go through the turnstile that night, instead of them giving you these ABCD coupons, they didn't do that. Instead, they give you a little band to put on your head, and it said, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, and had a big feather. Now, if you can imagine in my mental state to have to put on this, yeah, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, and this feather with 50,000 people all. And just as we got through the turnstile, the Tinkerbell Fairy sailed across the sky. See, that's all we need is the Tinkerbell Fairy flying around, you know. So finally we got to the flagpole. Well, my husband had got there and was off to buy popcorn. He's always off buying popcorn in every crisis of our life. When he dies, we're going to put on his tombstone, Bill is not here, he's out buying popcorn. Well, just as we were standing, they hadn't seen him since Tim's funeral, and so they were really glad to see him. I had seen him that morning, so I couldn't throw up or anything, you know. But it was so crowded. I want you to imagine all these great big electric chickens all lighted up. We're getting ready for this big parade, and people were jammed together. Men had kids sitting on their. Everybody wanting to watch this wonderful parade, and it was so crowded and so hot. So my sister said, "It's so crowded. We'll just go see Mr. Lincoln." Now the flagpole's here. Mr. Lincoln was here. The big chickens are there. Lost children's over there. And I said, "Oh, good. Go see Mr. Lincoln. I'll get rid of her." So she and her husband went back to see Mr. Lincoln. I'm still worried about our purple luggage, but I didn't have time to think about that too much. And so my son and I were left standing at the flagpole with 50,000 people with these feathers in our hats, you know. And he said, I think I'm homosexual. Well, you can't be. I know what the Bible says about that. You can't be. You're a Christian. You can't be. I know that. I know what the Bible says. And then he said, or maybe I'm bisexual. Bisexual. I never heard of that. That's not even in the Bible. That sounds like sex twice a month. Why would he say that? So as I'm standing there reading, thinking, what is he saying? Bicycle scared me to death. And some lady had a fat kid in the stroller, and they rolled over my leg. That isn't even funny. You people laugh at anything. Anyway, so the projection from the stroller cut into my leg, and I looked down, and I saw blood coming. And I thought, oh, how euphoric. I don't have to kill him. I don't have to tell anybody, because I'm just going to go to glory. I'm going to bleed to death right here. It was the most euphoric feeling I've ever had. Like, says God will make a way, you know. He'll make a way, and well, he'll make a way, because I'm going to die right here. It was the most, I've never had such a wonderful feeling that I don't have to tell anybody. Nobody's going to know, and I'm just going to die. And then I thought, but my trunk is full of all those magazines. And if Bill finds them, he'll think they're mine. So I thought, I can't die now. I've got to live long enough to go home and clean out my trunk. So he said he was sick and he wanted to go home. I said, well, I've already told him the trunk didn't open. What's one more thing? So he went home. They came back and we looked around Disneyland. I don't remember a thing about it. Just blissfully, it's a fog to me. I don't remember anything about that night. And then we got to the hotel and Bill had finished his popcorn. He was tired. He went to bed. And my sister and her husband, they were tired from the long trip from Hawaii. They went to bed. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever sobbed all night into a pillow. I never had done this before. But by 4:30 in the morning, I was hyperventilating. And this is 30 miles from home. We're staying in this Travelodge cheap hotel down there in Anaheim. And I thought, I'm having a heart attack. I mean, I got this elephant on my chest. My teeth were itching. I was sick to my stomach. I had all kinds of physicals. I'm having a heart attack, I guess. I never did this before. And finally, my husband woke up at 4:30, Father's Day morning. He said, what's the matter with you? I said, I think I'm having a heart attack. I don't know if you dial 911 or 411, but I just can't breathe. And I got elephant on my chest and my teeth itch. And he says, well, I thought you acted a little strange last night. A little strange. I'm glad you noticed. The most horrible night of my life. And he said, I want to know what's the matter with you. Oh, what a time on Father's Day morning to tell him this. And I said, well, I just found out last night that Larry's couldn't even say the word, homosexual. Wow. He got up. He knew what that was. He kind of got out of bed a little bit. And then I said, started telling the whole wad at once. Maybe he's even a bisexual. Bisexual. He didn't know what that was either. That scared him worse. So he got out of bed, zipped up his pants, putting on his clothes like he's going somewhere. I said, where are you going? Well, I'm going home to fix him. And I said, well, I'll just be dead when you come back. I'll just be dead. It didn't stop him at all. He putted off in his little Carmagia home 30 miles to fix the kid. While I'm laying there grabbing my chest thinking, I'm just dying. I'm going to die right now. I'm dying. Well, he went home. Pretty soon, my sister heard the little Carmagia go and heard our voices. And she came over, you know, knocking on the door. And she said, what's the matter? Did you and Bill have a fight? No, a fight I could handle. First, I was going to say, no, he always goes home to shave. Why would you pay money to go to a hotel and leave at 4:30 in the morning unless you had some big trouble? So I said, I was a little worried about her and that luggage and everything, but I said, I'll tell you what happened. So I went out to the car, and I brought in two armloads of all this magazine pictures and the whole thing, and I threw it on the bed. And I said, your nephew, not my son, but your nephew is a homosexual. Well, he can't be. He's a Christian. That's what I said. Now, her dad was a minister. My dad, too. We had the same dad. But anyway, she and I had never seen anything like that before. I never saw anything pornographic. If I saw pictures of men in their underwear in a Penny's catalog, that's as pornographic as I ever got. In the same way for her. And so here we are, looking at this stuff, trying to figure out what all this was. And then my brother-in-law, nice, square Baptist preacher, comes in. We went through the whole thing, telling him, oh, he's homosexual. Well, he can't be. He's a Christian. So we are standing, look at this stuff. And he ordinarily had straight hair. And as we looked at this stuff, I tell you, his hair got curly, that's for sure. He'd never seen anything like that. Neither did I, neither did she. And so we're looking at this stuff while my husband went home to fix the kid. Well, he's back in an hour and a half an hour home, half an hour to fix him, and half an hour back again. And he said, there's nothing wrong with him. You're making way too much of it. It's just a phase, and you're being too dramatic. You're being too emotional. But he didn't even know what bisexual was, or what he know. And so we went somehow to church. I don't remember anything about it. And then we went to Knott's Berry Farm for this chicken dinner, which I paid for Father's Day. You had to pay for it way ahead. I was crying. My sister was crying. My brother-in-law with his curly hair. And just passed all the food to Bill because we were too sick to even eat it. And then they left to go back to the nice white ivory soap world of Minneapolis where they don't have any homosexuals there. That's what they said. Then my husband had to leave to go take his dad his Father's Day present, and I went home to fix this situation. And I was going to say to him, you know, you will turn or burn. You will stop this right now. 1 John 1:9, you will do that, and we will not have this. We can't have this. And I said a lot of things. I even said I'd rather have a child be dead than be homosexual. I said a lot of unloving things. I didn't know anything. And I tell parents now to shove a sock in your mouth and don't be so omnipotent. Listen to what your kid is trying to tell you. But I didn't do that. And because I didn't do that, he went in his room crying and I went in my room crying. And this was the kid that was always the blessing, the joy, the peacemaker, the one that knew how to smooth over the troubled water. But it sure didn't help that day. The next day I went down to Anaheim near us. And there's a hotline center down there, and boy, do I need help. And so I went into this hotline center, and I said, I just found out my son's a homosexual, and I want to talk to a mother in here that can help me. And mother, we don't have any mothers in here. I said, where are they, all in the Home for the Bewildered or something? There must be a mother that can tell me I'm going to get through this, because I think I'm dying. I just can't live with this. He said, we don't have any mothers. We have a couple ex-homosexuals. Don't want to talk to them. I don't want anything to do with homosexuals. I just want to talk to a mother. They don't have any mothers. So I remember slamming the door, and I went out, and I thought, if I ever get through this, I promise God I will start some kind of a ministry to help devastated Christian parents when they go through this. But see, I thought I was going to die anyway. When you're going to die, you promise God anything. And I went home, and this boy who had lived there happily for 20 years, been nothing but a delight and a joy, had moved out, was gone. Nothing was left in his room. He took everything. I'd only been gone a couple hours. Somebody had come and moved him out. And I called Bill, and he said, well, where would he go? He'll call. Where would he go? He had a little red Volkswagen that belonged to me because of the insurance. He had a job at a local hamburger place. He had tickets. He's supposed to go to all these with his Christian singing group. Where would he go? He had scholarships to go to school, but he was gone. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to tell anybody. We know now that openness is to wholeness, the secrets are to sickness. And if you don't tell somebody and ventilate, you're going to get sick. And I was getting sick. If I went to the grocery store and I saw homogenized milk, I think, homosexual milk, see? I went to a couple funerals. That was good because you can cry at a funeral and nobody expects you to be happy. So I could go and just cry. Bill went off to work every day because he said it was just a phase and I was the one that was emotional. I thought, well, I'll write to some of these Christian leaders. Start with Billy Graham. What do you do when you have a beautiful 20-year-old child that disappears into the homosexual lifestyle? The letters that they sent me back were hilarious. One of them said is I should send my son Shorts to Texas to be prayed for. One of them said it was a spirit. One said it was a demon. One said the Antichrist is going to be homosexual. That's a real help there. And they sent me little vials of oil. Well, I never had oil before. I don't know whether you put it on your hair or you drink it or what do you do, but I had all this anointing oil, which I didn't know what I was doing. So I had it anyway in case I needed it. And so nobody was helping me. I couldn't want to call my sister. I called her a lot, and I got a $600 phone. I thought, boy, she's no help because she just cries, and I worried about her purple luggage anyway. And so I was in this by myself. I stayed back in the bedroom, and I just counted the roses on the wallpaper, and I just wanted to die. Because Bill just lived on popcorns, I didn't cook anything. My younger son worked at Taco Bell. That saved his life. And so several months went by, and I didn't eat anything. Because I didn't eat anything, I lost a lot of weight. I gained it all back. But I'm really a perfect 10 under here. I just keep it covered with fat so it won't get scratched. So as the months went by, I didn't clean anything. I didn't do anything. Bill just put up a couple get well cards on the mantle so people would come over and think, well, poor Barbara, she's sick. She can't clean, you know. And people were saying, oh, poor Barbara, she hasn't got over the deaths of her two sons. Well, it wasn't those two sons. They were with the Lord. They were deposits in heaven. I could say, praise God, Stephen and Tim are in heaven with the Lord. But how could I explain this beautiful 20-year-old talented darling boy who just disappeared from our lives. He had dated a lot of my women friends' daughters, and I couldn't tell them anything. I couldn't tell anybody, so I was just dying all by myself. And Bill went off to work and thought it was a phase, and I was being too emotional. He was no help at all. Usually men aren't a whole lot of help when you go through this. I'll tell you that ahead of time. But anyway, and so after almost a year went by, I was so depressed and all by myself, nobody to talk to. I said to Bill one day, I wish that you used double-edged razor blades instead of electric shaver. And he said, why? And I said, because if I swallow one and put it in a piece of bread, it might kill me. And he said, you got to see somebody. So he made an appointment for me to see a psychiatrist or psychologist, whatever charges $80 an hour. So I went in to see this man, and I told him how he was feeling, and he said, well, you're very depressed. Well, I know I'm depressed. Gosh, anybody wants to swallow a razor blade, you know you're depressed. You don't need somebody to pay money to tell you that. And he said, well, if he's been gone a year now, very possibly he never will come home again. He probably has found enough support in the gay life that he won't need the fellowship of the family. Not come home again, this darling, blonde, bubbly boy who's the light of our... Not come home again. Well, when I left his office, I was really depressed. And so he called my husband and he said, Barbara's so depressed, I think we're going to have to put her in Parkside West, which is the Looney Tunes where I live. That's where you go and make baskets and earrings and stuff. Can you believe I was in a retreat lately, and you know what they were going to do? They were going to make baskets and earrings for their crafts. Very frugal. Tight is the real word. And he said, well, if my insurance will cover her, she can go, but otherwise she's not vicious or anything. So these are my choices. If his insurance covers me, I get to go spend time with all these loony people and make baskets. Or otherwise, if it doesn't cover me, I'll stay home and count the roses on the wallpaper, what I've been doing for a year. That's terrible kind of options for me. So I got in the car the next day, and I drove down to a high point near Disneyland. There's a high viaduct. And I thought, I just can't live like this. I'm not functioning as a wife. I'm not functioning as a mother. I'm not thinking I'm a Christian. I don't want to go to church. I just want to be out of here. I'm just like a zero with a rim rubbed out. I'm absolutely not good to anybody. I just can't handle this pressure. I had this elephant on my chest, all these physical signs of panic. I couldn't talk to anybody. I'm just not worth living. I can't handle this pain in my chest and all the pressure. And I got to the top of the viaduct, and I thought, I'm just going to drive this car over here. And then I thought, but what if I'm just maimed? And then I'm making baskets, and I'm all crippled up. And I thought, I don't want that. And I said, Lord, I'm a Christian. I accepted you when I was a little girl. I don't remember when I wasn't, really. But I can't live with this elephant on my chest. I'm not functioning as a person. I'm not a wife. I got a kid. I haven't talked to him. My other boy, I don't even know what he's doing. And my husband hasn't eaten for a year. And I don't want to go to church because I don't even think I'm saved. So I just don't want to live. And I said, whatever, Lord. I meant the prayer of relinquishment, like Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And I said, in desperation, I said, whatever, Lord, if I never see him, if he never comes back, if you kill him, if I kill him, whatever, he's yours. I can't even find him, and you love him more than I do. So whatever. And I took a hammer out of my imagination. I thought I'd given him to God before, like 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your care upon him. Well, I did that. I kept giving him to God, but I kept picking him up again. And I'm going to nail that kid at the bottom of the cross. He's your property. You love him. He's a prodigal child. You will go after him. I can't live like this. And when I said, whatever, Lord, like Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. When I said that, I felt this wonderful, exhilarating feeling, like for the first time, that elephant came off my chest, and that heaviness I had, all I had said is, whatever, Lord, nothing happened to my kid, but I said, whatever, Lord, the prayer of relinquishment. And I felt so relieved, and I sang all the way home, and I hadn't sung for a whole year. Boy, I sang, the King is coming, and come on down, Lord Jesus. I was just a transformed person. So I got home, and I quit calling my husband, who was trying to put me in the home. And I said, oh, Bill, the most wonderful thing happened. He said, where are you? I said, well, I'm home. He said, where have you been? Well, I went down to Anaheim, and I was going to kill myself, and then I decided I might be maimed. I'd be maimed making baskets, so I nailed him to the cross. He said, what? And I think he thought I waited too long. I should have put her in yesterday. And he said, don't talk to anybody. Don't call anybody. Now, he's the one that had brain damage, didn't know anybody for 2 years. And he's telling me, don't call anybody, don't talk to anybody, I'm coming right home. I said, no, you don't have to come home, but he already hung up the phone, started home. So he came in, and he sat down in the living room, I'll never forget, he sat down, and he tipped back his chair, he said, now tell me what happened, where have you been? You have been a zombie for the last year, what's happened to you? And I started to tell him, I went down this, and every time I got to the part about nailing him to the cross, he had some kid hang on the 57 freeway, I think, you know, thinking that something horrible happened. And I got all through the whole story, how God had relieved me, and he had just given me this beautiful bubble of joy. And he tipped back his chair, and he said, well, I'm sure glad you're feeling better, because my insurance didn't cover you anyhow. I started cleaning. Had a lot of cleaning to do. Nobody, popcorn wrappers all over the place. My other boy worked at Taco Bell. Taco Bell wrappers all over. Nobody had done anything in a year. You can imagine the house. So I turned on my music. And I was singing. I hadn't sung in a year. I was singing. I was just a transformed person. And the next day, I was still doing that. You don't clean that up in one day. So the next day, I was still singing and cleaning. And this boy called that we hadn't heard from him for a year. And he said, Mom, I'm at In-N-Out Hamburgers. I want to bring you a hamburger. What do you want on it? Well, he knew what I wanted on it, but if he'd have called the day before, I would have said, you little creep, don't you know they're ready to put me in the home for the bewildered? But instead of that, I said, oh, honey, anything's fine. Anything's fine. I felt such love for him. Anything's fine. So he came home, and just before he got home, I thought, now, he and I were the fun. We used to play jokes and have lots of fun. I thought, he's been gone a year. If I had a little doll, I could wrap it up, pretend that we could have a three-month-old baby. Miracles happen, you know. I didn't have any dolls around, but we had the dog, cute little black dog. And I thought I could wrap up the dog, have to cut off his tail, because he had a long tail. And then I thought, Lord, thank you for even giving me the thought of wrapping up the dog and pretending we had a baby in the last year, because I hadn't thought of anything funny for a year. That's the first funny thing, wrapping up the dog and cutting off his tail and pretending. So I could see that God had restored something that had been missing for a whole year for me. Well, anyway, I didn't do that. Poor, too painful for the dog. And so he came in. We ate the hamburgers and talked. He was going to UCLA, doing real good at school, living by himself, going to church all by himself, and driving the car and had a job. So, golly, I thought, well, maybe Bill was right for once. I mean, it could be right that everything is all right. It's just a phase. Then he came home the next week to see his brother and his dad. I didn't show him my oil or my prayer clothes or anything that I had. I hid it all away. I thought, isn't it ironic? A year ago, he's hiding his stuff from me, and now I got prayer clothes and oil, and I'm hiding it all from him. But anyway, he was coming home every week then, and we were having a just talk about service things. We didn't talk about any deep things or homosexuality or anything. We just talked about what he was doing, which seemed to be good. Another year went by, and he graduated from UCLA, and we went over there because he was one of the top students, and he had a job and active in his church, and everything was fine. And I thought, well, I just made too much of something I didn't need to do. And about that time, Bethany called me and wanted me to write a book, a story about my husband's accident, about Stephen and about Tim, and then about this boy, Larry, that had been gone for a year and had returned. So I told him they wanted me to write a book. And he said, how could you write a book? I don't know. I hardly passed English in school. I don't know how I could. But the Holy Spirit will propel it. They told me that at Bethany, that the Lord would propel it. Well, he'd sure have to, because I couldn't write a book. Anyway, my son said he didn't care. Who would read such a boring book anyway, such a drastic story? I said, well, I don't know. It's okay with you? He said, sure, I don't care if you write the book. So I wrote the book, Where Does the Mother Go to Resign? And then after you do a few programs like Focus on the Family, 700 Club, PTL, or no, scratch that one. But after you do some of those programs, the book got put on successful living racks, so it was at the airports and the Piggly Wiggly markets and all over. The book had only been out about 4 months, and I had done several programs. When he called me on the phone, and he said, I don't like it that you wrote that book. I said, well, you said I could. Well, I don't like it that you wrote the book. And I go to the airport, and there's your book. And I go to the market, and there's the book. And I turn on the radio, and there you're on there. And I turn on the TV, and there you're on there. And I just don't like it. I said, well, it's kind of late now. You should have told me before I wrote it. He said, well, I didn't think you could write it, and I sure didn't think anybody wanted to read it. He said, I want to tell you something, and I want you to get this straight. Straight. When I heard the word straight, wow, I kind of came alive there. And he said, I want you to get this straight. I have a lover in my life. Ugh, that just sunk me right there. And he said, I'm going to disown my family, change my name, and I never want to see any of you again. Wow, this is only 2 years after I said, whatever, Lord. And I said, whatever, Lord, but gee, I didn't really mean that. And this is on the phone, and I said to him, and I wasn't even crying, I said, well, I want God's best for you, and I don't think homosexuality is God's best for anybody, but I can't change you, I can't fix you, I can't even lose weight, how can I help somebody else? And so I said, only two things I'm going to do for you. I'm going to love you, and I'm going to pray for you. And then I said, the porch light is always on for you. And then we hung up the phone. And I called Bill, and by this time I was crying, I said, he's going to disown us and change his name and never wants to see us again. And Bill said, well, he can't do that. I mean, how could he do that? 2 days later, we got a registered letter from the Los Angeles court that he had disowned us. And he had changed his name. And he told me he never wanted to see us again. Boy, that's real rejection, you know. And what were we going to do? We had this ministry growing called Spatula Ministries for parents who land on the ceiling when they have kids in trouble. And I was speaking all over. Just because you've been on Focus on the Family, people think you know something. It doesn't mean a thing, but they think you know something. And you get invited to speak a lot of places. So I had to decide, what are we going to do? People would say, how is your family now? Well, my two sons have not risen from the dead. And my third son has disowned us, changed his name, never wants to see us again. Boy, isn't that a victorious story? But as I was telling that, I was telling parents that God only gives a score in a life when the game is over. And the game ain't over yet with my kids, or with your kid if you have a wayward child. And Proverbs 11:21 says, God will rescue the children of the righteous. So this is what I was telling people. And the more I told, the more the ministry just blew apart, and it blossomed. And so I had chances to speak all over the country, and that was my message, that I was living in a hope-deferred situation. Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but when dreams come true at last, there's life and hope. And this is my message. Now, I'm taking you from that night at Disneyland 11 years ahead. We hadn't seen him, didn't know where he was, didn't know what was happening. I was out speaking, doing all kind of programs. And my message was what I had just explained to you. And we were getting ready to go to Minneapolis to speak for a Mother's Day weekend thing. And he called on the phone and said, I want to come home and bring you a Mother's Day present. Now, if you hadn't heard from your kid in 11 years and he disowned you and changed his name, I thought, oh, he's going to marry that guy. I don't have a lot of faith. I've got a lot of hope and joy, but I don't have a lot of faith. Can't have every gift, you know. And first I was going to say, no, I can't have somebody come and bust my bubble of joy. I've got to go to Minneapolis and talk to these women. And Bill said, no, have him come home no matter what. He's going to bring you a present anyway, so good. So I said, okay, come home. We're leaving to go to Minneapolis this afternoon, but if you come over right away, we'll be here and wait for you. So he came over. He walked in the door. He didn't even have me a present. And I remember thinking, that kid don't even have me a Mother's Day present. And he's supposed to be bringing me a present. Anyway, he came in and sat down, had big tears in his eyes, and he said, I want you to forgive me for the 11 years of pain that I caused you because I went to an advanced seminar last week and I rededicated my life to the Lord. And I took all the evidence of the old life to a fireplace and I burned it. And while it was burning, I felt complete sense of release for the first time in 11 years that I can stand clean before the Lord. And the young man he was living with, if you saw him, you would know him because he's real big on TV ads and Coca-Cola ads and stuff. He said his mother had committed suicide right after she found out he was homosexual, and his dad had had a stroke. So here he went forward and accepted the Lord the next night. So my son, he rededicated his life to the Lord, and this other boy, a brand new Christian. But at first, I didn't want to tell it, because I thought, what if I go tell all this and go on some programs, and then they slip back? I don't have any faith, do I? But as it worked out, now several years have gone by. This is since 1986, and my son is active in his church. He's serving the Lord. He helps him with the ministry. He stands tall. His eyes are clear, and his voice sounds like it used to. And that awful, evil thing that was capturing him is not there anymore, and he's gotten a little bit older, so he's gotten more mature, and he's the biggest help to us. And recently on a Focus on the Family program, they did a surprise for me, and your tape man here is going to play it. I hope it sets so you don't have to hear a lot of Dr. Dobson, but see what you can do, okay?
Barbara, it's quite an act of compassion that you allow people that you don't even know to reach out to you with such misery. Most of us have such difficulties in our lives, we don't need anybody else's. And it's one thing to put your arm around a brother or sister at church who's hurting, somebody that you've known through the years, and to try to help them. It's another thing to tell the whole world that you'll accept their problems. Not only their problems, but their misery. You have done that through the years. I don't know many people like that. My hat is off to you. It doesn't have a geranium in it, but it's off to you. And I really do appreciate who you are.
Well, I appreciate being here. It's always fun to come and laugh and hear what you have to say. And I love that you smile so easy. I mean, he smiles so quickly. Yeah. And that's good. That's healing for you that you can laugh and smile as much as you do.
I'd rather laugh than cry.
It's better.
Creates a few wrinkles around the eyes, but I'll take those any day. Barbara, thank you again for being in the studio with us and sharing once more from your heart. You've been a regular guest, and I know you've offered so much help to our listeners. I have a surprise for you today.
Oh.
Our staff has done something that we're going to air in just a moment as we close out the broadcast, and I think it's going to put a smile on your face. Can you stay with us?
Oh, I'd love to. That'll be great.
How can you say no?
We've placed a phone call just a short time ago to Barbara Johnson's son that she has referred to a number of times, and he has a message that we want to leave you with.
The 11 years of estrangement were difficult years for both my parents and I. And during that time, it became very evident to me of the gripping power of bitterness and resentment that has engulfed our family. But now, however, we're all grateful for God's healing restoration. And if you've read my mother's book, Stick a Geranium in Your Hat and Be Happy, you'll know more of the details and the impact of her ministry and my situation and of those people that have been similarly situated. I'm thankful for you and your listeners that have prayed for me and my family, and can only offer this word of advice at this time. If we as Christians can purpose in our hearts to be kind and loving in all that we do, and put away a condemning spirit and learn the fear of the Lord, then surely the light of Christ will be able to shine in our disbelieving world, and restoration and revival will take root in the lives of those that we touch on a daily basis.
Thank you. I told you that I wanted you to go out of here, smile a lot and laugh a lot tonight, and I see a lot of you are crying, so I want to tell you something, how important it is, on a happy note I want to end so you go out of here laughing, how important it is that you learn to build memories in the walls of your family. Now, like when Stephen was killed, and I have to tell my story over and over again many times a year, I could almost smell that flowers and see that brown, swollen body. And I said, Lord, I want to tell my story, but you're going to have to give me a frozen picture of him so that when I tell my story, I don't actually go through the whole thing again and relive the emotional thing. You're going to have to give me a frozen picture. You have to windshield wipe that painful one and replace it. And God did something really special for me. So I remembered a time when he came home from school. He was about 17. And he had this beautiful light green sweater that a girl had crocheted for him. It was just lovely. And he was so proud of it. We all admired the sweater. Then he came home a day later and he spilled hot chocolate all over the front. He said, oh, I ruined my sweater. I spilled hot chocolate on. I said, oh, no, no. I'll wash it for you. We'll be fine. Don't you touch my sweater. You might shrink my sweater. And he gave me all these instructions. So I waited till he went to school. And like any mother would do, then I washed the sweater and wool it. It came out beautiful. Put it in his drawer. And that day I was down at a little Barbie and Ken doll toy store and where they sell doll clothes, and I found this little green sweater. Now, it was the same color as his sweater, and it was made the same way with a little ribbing at the top and ribbing here. Exactly. And I said, I've got to have that. So I bought it and I brought it home and I put it on his bed like that. Well, he came in from school, and he took one look at that sweater, and he said, you boiled my sweater. It looks like a coaster. And he tried to pull it. Oh, he was so mad at me. I just let him rip away and rip away, you know, until he got all exhausted. And then I said, oh, Stephen, look in your drawer. So he opened the drawer, and there was his nice, fat, puffy. He was so humiliated, you know. And he came over, and he put his arm around me, and he said, well, I knew you wouldn't hurt my sweater. Well, he thought I did, you know. So I've been able to windshield wipe that painful memory of the past with him, and I've been able to replace it. And how important it is to do that when you have a memory, you know. You know why women over 50 don't have babies? Because they'd put them out somewhere and forget where they left them. So make your memories while you're young. And I wanted to give you a verse. I haven't even given you a verse tonight. You won't even think I'm saved. I want to try something on you. How important it is, Philippians 4:8. Think on things that are good and pure and lovely. How important it is to do that. I want to give you a little test, see how you guys do. Okay, there were two men. One was married, had a nice wife and a nice family. And he said to this other man who was not married, you ought to get you a nice wife and family, settle down. It's just so wonderful. And the man said, well, I'd like to, but I've got a lot of criteria. I've got a lot of standards. And the man said, well, like what? He said, well, she's got to be a Christian. She's got to have it here. She's got to have it here, and she's got to be like this. And the other man looked at him real quizzically, and he said, I can understand why you want a Christian, and you want one that has brains and money, but why would you want one with arthritis? Now, see, you were thinking of a Dolly Parton type joke. Well, you're a wonderful audience. You laugh at the right time. You cry at the wrong time. That's all right. And it's been really wonderful to share with you. And I hope tonight we've conveyed to you how God's faithfulness and His ability to love us, even when we're not lovable, and even when we're kicking against the pricks, how He does love us, and His love covers us, and He does send sparkles into our life and splashes of joy into our life, even at a time when we think we're desolate and alone. He's always there to remind us. And I appreciate being able to be here. We're going to have a good time this weekend, and God bless you.